House Committee on Education will come to order. And I apologize that we're 2 seconds down the road. I mean, minutes down the road there. I lost track of time as I was predicting as well. Welcome back, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Representative Farr is out with the bugs, so we will miss her. So she will be not with us today.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to see you. I was walking her. Meet that bug.
Absolutely.
Keep going.
Thank you. We're going to have some informational meeting hearings today. We're going to have some great information from University of Oregon as well as from the Oregon Department of Education. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. And just as a friendly reminder, the House Committee on Education is fundraising for school, so that effort is funded by your cooperation or lack thereof in regard to using acronyms. So if you have a whole pot full of them that you'd like to use, please give us the full definition first and then proceed to use the acronym thereon later down the road in your presentation. And also checking your cell phones. Would appreciate that they would be off. So, with that, we will begin with Tony Gillis.
Joni Gillis, I'm sorry.
I knew that. From the giving us some information about the Reading First program.
She'll do all the introductions.
Perfect.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joni Gillis with the Oregon Department of Education. I'm the management point for the agency's literacy initiative as well as the director of the Reading First program. Superintendent Castillo has said many times and firmly believes that all students have the right to be literate, not just the opportunity, but the right. This core belief is the driving force behind the agency's literacy initiative. I would like to begin this presentation by talking about the Oregon Reading First program within the context of the literacy initiative, and then I'm going to ask Dr. Ed Kamianui, who's renowned nationally for his critical role that he's played in the research behind and the implementation of Reading First, and then Dr. Scott Baker, who is a man who loves his data and will use the data to tell a story of our Reading First schools in Oregon. And then we'll follow up the presentation with Patricia Book, who is the principal at Aloha Park in the Beaverton School District, and she will talk to us about what Reading First looks like at the school level. The convergence of many factors have led us to where we are today with the Oregon Reading Initiative. First of all, there's a sense of urgency that reading is fundamental. It's a gateway skill for students to be able to access all other knowledge. Secondly, there's accountability. No Child Left Behind, the school report card, adequate yearly progress. These are all examples of how states, districts, and schools are being held accountable. Thirdly, there's a convergence of research. We have mature and emerging research that tells us what is working. And fourth, and the one that we're going to spend time talking about today, is the funding. At the federal level, they are funding programs in which we can implement scientifically based research. So we need, at the department, we feel we need to begin early, we need to finish strong, if we are to have all of our students be able to have the right to be literate. I'll call your attention then to page 2 that has more information on the Oregon Reading First program. This is a 6-year grant. Over 5 years, the Department of Education will receive approximately $50 million. 80% of these funds are grants and aid that go directly to the schools and to the districts. 20% are funds that we can keep at the state level and do professional development and technical assistance to assist all K-3 students and teachers. The eligibility for Reading First is it's based on performance and poverty. The third grade reading assessment scores are used to determine the schools that are struggling the most at that level, and then we use our free and reduced lunch data to give us the poverty. So it's performance and then poverty. We have our first group of Reading First schools, we refer to as Cohort A. We have 15 districts and 35 schools that have qualified. They are in their second year of implementation. They are, and there's a list in the back that gives you the districts, the schools, as well as some information on the demographics, the number of special ed students, English language learners, as well as poverty. Thank you. They represent both urban and rural districts throughout the state, and I think you can see that there's a fairly good geographic representation as well. We are also getting ready to bring on Cohort B. We have met with them several times. Their applications to become a Reading First school are due on March 4th. The awards will be made in April. And then they will begin their implementation. They will have professional development throughout the summer, and their implementation will begin the next school year. In addition, or as part of our Cohort B group of schools, we have an option for schools that have dual language immersion programs. We have an option that they can instruct their provide reading instruction in both English and Spanish. Right now we have 7 schools that are very interested in that opportunity. We're meeting with them next Monday, actually, to begin talking about the plan of what this is going to look like. We're the first state that really has tackled this, and so we're very excited about the opportunities that we can provide for these students, as well as what we're going to learn for with the schools about the students and what strategies are most effective for our English language learners.
Ms. Gillis, may I, before you proceed, dual language immersion. So can you give me just a little clearer picture of that?
Madam Chair, yes. Dual language immersion is educating the students in both Spanish and in English. And so they will have the native language literacy, which will be the literacy in Spanish as well as English. They will be held accountable in terms of meeting benchmarks in both Spanish and in English, so that by grade 3 they're literate in both languages.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair? It's
Representative Lin.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Why it has to be English and Spanish? Why couldn't be English and Japanese, English and Chinese?
Madam Chair, Representative Lin, that's an excellent question. Right now, especially with Reading First, these schools have to meet all the very rigorous scientifically based research. We have a great body of knowledge now on Spanish language programs. It is not as much in terms of in Russian, in terms of some of the other languages. And I think as that research emerges, that we will be able to, to do some more work in other languages. But for right now, it is just the research only is. There's other research in other languages, but the only one that we can use for Reading First is the Spanish.
Thank
and
you.
I'm going to ask Scott and Ed if there's anything that you'd like to add with that, please.
Thank
I guess not. I guess I gave.
Okay.
So did that answer your question?
Thank you. Yes. Okay.
You're welcome.
A follow-up on Representative Lim, if I could. Do we know what happens to those other students that speak other languages that do not have a program? What happens to them?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, then they are those students. In fact, we have quite a few of our Reading First schools that have maybe 12, 15 languages within the classroom. They are now instructed in all the components of Reading First in English only, and I think our research will show that they're doing, they're doing quite well. So However, we do have some Reading First schools that had existing bilingual programs, and we wanted to honor what they were doing by using the research to say that they could do native language literacy in Spanish as well as English.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Follow-up. I want to be sure I understood that. We have schools that have students with other languages, and those students are doing quite well in English only? Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, yes.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to...
If you would identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank Madam you. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Kameinui. I teach at the University of Oregon. I'm a professor in the College of Education. I'm also the director of the Oregon Reading First Center, and I also direct a national center that provides technical assistance to 22 states in the western region of the United States on Reading First. So I offer both a state perspective and then a regional and maybe national perspective on the whole implementation of Reading First that Joni has outlined. I think the question you offer, Representative Dahlem, is a very important one. The question is, what do we do, how do schools manage languages other than English in terms of getting kids to read so that they're reading in English and meeting our state benchmarks, right? I mean, if you want to take a large-scale example, Los Angeles Unified School District has 88 different languages, 800,000 kids. So how do we as a system manage so many different languages? Well, for all practical purposes, we don't. We focus primarily on English, and then we provide the support that kids need to learn English. In our case, we focus on languages that are most prominent, such as Spanish, to try and provide the support. And the question is, how do you draw on someone's native language, in a sense, both to preserve and learn the native language, but also to use that language as a means of learning English? So you run into all kinds of resource issues in trying to provide support to lots of different languages, because those languages have different writing systems. For example, in Japanese, you use a different writing system, logographic system, or a syllabary system with other languages. So now you're asking schools to not only teach English, but teach writing systems and other languages, and you come up against the problem very quickly in terms of support and capacity and knowledge and how to do this in a way that we're going to get kids to our assessments in a successful way.
One follow-up. How do we deal with, and I'm looking from the student's perspective, if I'm a non-English speaking student in Spanish, I have a program. How do we deal with equity then for that multitude of students in other languages? How do we provide an equal education?
That's Madam Chairman and Representative Dahlem, that's a very good question. And I'm not sure I have a good answer for that in terms of equity. Equity has to, you have to index it somehow in terms of achievement. So how do kids get at the benchmarks we want them to get at in terms of reading achievement for languages other than English? And
Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Well, Spanish, I think Dr. Baker will talk about what we're trying to do with Spanish. But with other languages, it becomes a really enormous challenge for us, especially in areas where there are multiple languages, yet we don't have teachers who can speak the languages, who can teach in that language, or in a writing system that's captured by that language. So I don't know if, Scott, you want to say anything?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, for the record, my name is Scott Baker, and I'm the Director of Evaluation for Oregon Reading First at the University of Oregon and Pacific Institutes for Research. And I've been involved in the English language learner issue with Reading First since its inception. And there were many schools that wanted to use Reading First resources to provide reading instruction in the student's primary language, Spanish. In some cases, it was Russian. And our interpretation of the Reading First legislation was that the K-3 kindergarten through third grade program, which is Reading First, needed to focus on getting students to be proficient in the state's grade level standards, which in Oregon are start in third grade. The goal for all Reading First schools and states is to make sure that all kids, all children K-3, regardless of native language or status in special education, other variables like those, all kids meet grade level expectations in the state in which the child goes to school. So the first group of schools, the 34 schools that are now part of Cohort A, are working towards getting all of their kids, including English language learners, whether they're native Spanish speakers or native Russian speakers or speakers of some other language, to the state level goals in English at the end of third grade. Now that is a considerable challenge for those children, but when we look at our data, when we look at the data we have for all kids, including native English speakers, it's a challenge for many kids, even native English speakers. So one of the primary focus areas for us is to work heavily on early literacy skills, beginning reading skills in kindergarten and first grade. And what we're finding is that we can get many kids who come to school at risk for reading problems, and we can identify those kids quite well early. As soon as they enter school, we can identify which kids are at risk for reading problems. We can get many of those kids to our benchmarks, our early benchmarks, before third grade. We have benchmarks in kindergarten and first grade. We can get many kids to those benchmarks when we provide them with intensive instruction. And it seems that, from the data, that we can provide the same kinds of instructional opportunities, perhaps more intense for English language learners, and that many of those kids can reach the same benchmarks, even though they are learning not only to read in English, which is a challenge, but they're also learning to use the language. They're learning a new language at the same time. So the goals for Reading First and our English language learners in Cohort A are the same as the goals for the native English speakers, and we're tracking that quite closely to make sure that if children need more intensive instruction to reach those goals, they get it regardless of whether or not their native language is English or some other language.
Thank you, Joni. It was not my intent to derail your presentation.
However, I would like to clarify, when I said they're doing quite well within the context of Reading First, they may have began at risk and then they're moving up, and we're seeing that they're making benchmarks. So it was, you know, it was in the context of Reading First. On page 3, the top slide then refers to the statewide outreach that Reading First is able to provide. As you can see, it's quite a well-funded initiative, and we use some of these funds to provide professional development, technical assistance to both our Reading First schools and our non-Reading First schools. We're trying to stretch the dollars, leverage the funds as best we can. Some of the activities that we've been able to provide to the state using Reading First funds, we have funded 35 Pathfinder schools. These are non-Reading First schools. They do not have funds for programs, for materials. However, they receive the same very, very rich and deep professional development that all the Reading First schools receive. We have also been able to provide Lexiles for all students third through 12th grade in the state. This is a common scale that matches readability to text difficulty, and on every state report card that a student receives, a student report card, there's a Lexile score there, so that teachers can look for materials that are appropriate for the reading level of their students, and parents can take the Lexile score then to the public library and find materials. Maybe a student might be very interested in dinosaurs and can look at an appropriate reading level for that topic. Reading First has been able to fund that. We have also been able to fund a measure. It's the dynamic indicator of basic early literacy skills. It's kind of a dipstick that can kind of tell us how students are doing very quickly. From now on, if we may refer to that as Dibbles. Is that okay? And we've been able to provide training in basic and advanced Dibbles and EDEL, which is the Spanish version, for teachers, K-3 teachers throughout the state, not just Reading First teachers. We've trained over 1,000 teachers in that. Also, the teachers have access to the Dibbles database, and that's a very, very rich database that can give them kind of almost immediate data on how their students are doing. That's available to K-3 teachers throughout the state. Reading First has funded the Literacy Leadership State Steering Committee. This is a committee that's jointly appointed by the governor and the superintendent, and it assists and guides the Department of Education in the coordination of a seamless and comprehensive literacy efforts. And lastly, the Reading First has been able to fund a panel of national experts that have been able to come to Oregon and assist us as we've taken a look at the research on how English language learners learn best, the most effective strategies, so that we can include that in part of our literacy initiative. And now, if there's no questions, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Ed Kamehanui, and he will begin to talk a little bit about nationally what Reading First is, and then also what it looks like in Oregon.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I want to first thank Joni and her colleagues, Dr. Salamnor, for their hard work on this effort. Their commitment to this is, I think, an example for all 50 Reading First states in terms of how to keep the focus, use resources wisely, and implement a federal initiative that I think is a very important initiative for us in education. So I want to thank Joni and her colleagues for their good work. I want to also focus on page number 3, and I'm going to make a few comments on the second bottom slide. You've seen this kind of proposition held out through No Child Left Behind, and I wanted to linger there just a minute because it says all children will read at grade level by the end of grade 3, and it seems kind of like a slogan. But the reason it's important is that the research on this, and I'm saying the best research we can bring to the table in education, and our research in education sometimes gets very messy. It's probably very messy when compared to Ben Sciences, is the best research we have. Whether it's out of the National Institute of Health or the U.S. Department of Education, whatever. But what's clear about this is if we don't get children reading by the end of third grade, the probability that they'll read at 8th grade, 12th grade, and down the road is about 10%. So that's why this thing gets invoked. We need to have systems in place, resources in place, so that kids can negotiate this rather complex symbolic system. It's an alphabetic system, and the literature tells us you've got to attend to those symbols. And now, some kids do it rather easy. Most kids need some pretty good instruction, and that's why Reading First is so unusual, because in a sense, it says, we know enough about this. We know how to do this. Now, how do we put it in systems like schools that are complex places? So that's what I wanted to note about that. The items that Joni talked about in the slide above it, when she talked about the advanced Dibbles work, Dibbles is a measurement system, and she called it a dipstick. It's a one-minute measurement piece. You ask kids to read for a minute, and here's what it does. It grabs that sample of reading behavior, and it predicts the future. You can take that one-minute sample and know whether or not kids will be on track. If you take it in first grade, you'll know whether or not they'll be on track in third grade or down the road. So to me, if you think about it, it's a heck of a system to take a snapshot, a quick sample of a behavior that lets us know, hey, this kid's off track, we better do something different. So that to me is a progress monitoring system that is absolutely important, and it's available to all schools in Oregon free. So that's another piece of
Through whom? Through
through any support, through Reading First, through the Oregon Department of Education, through the University of Oregon, the Oregon Reading First Center, and we're continuously providing professional development support to provide teachers on this assessment system to support them. If I can get you to turn to the next page, page 4, those two slides basically just capture this federal initiative, which is Part B of the No Child Left Behind Act. And at this point in time, all 50 states have been funded. Oregon was one of the first states for which the grant was approved on the first round. Many states took two to three rounds to get the grant approved and awarded. So I think, again, it's testimony to the Oregon Department of Ed's good work and their leadership. 75,000 teachers have been involved in this effort. About 1.4 million children across the United States, 4,300 schools on Reading First. The difference between Reading First and previous federal initiatives like the Reading Excellence Act under President Clinton or other initiatives is that Reading First requires schools to look at the research and use the best science we have instead of our opinion. Now, that sounds like very common sense to you, but we don't do that enough in education, in my perspective. We tend to go with opinion, we tend to go with experience, and not look at the science. So that, to me, is an important piece. And you can note...
Anyway, I'm sorry, I slaughtered that. I won't try it again. Representative Dahlin has a question for you.
When you say all schools, that's all Title I schools, or is that all schools across the nation?
It's all schools that meet the criteria, either title, the poverty criteria, or the performance and the performance criteria. So it's really selected schools that are really struggling in states.
And that would be about half the a little less than half the schools in Oregon.
I'm going to defer to my colleagues here at the Oregon
the
Department.
Numbers.
I don't know if it's half or.
Madam Chair, Representative Dalton, I'm not exactly sure on the numbers. I don't know that at the elementary level it's half the schools, but we can get that information and then get that to you.
Thank you.
Yes. Madam Chairman, if I could continue then. The intent of... I'm sorry?
Excuse me.
Oh, no. No. The intent of Reading First as a federal initiative is, again, prevention. It's a critical piece because the opposite of prevention is remediation. And remediation is so much more expensive. The older kids are, the more difficult it is to turn this reading problem around. I mean, again, the odds are not in our children's favor when they can't read by the end of grade 3 because then they're not motivated to read the vocabulary. They don't have all the words they need to access information, and it becomes an enormously difficult issue. So that's why we focus on prevention in K-3. And the assumption is that this problem with reading is preventable, and the peculiar thing about it is preventable by good instruction. So... I'll call your attention then to the next page, page 5, and we talk about kind of the DNA, the structure. What are the critical pieces you have to live with in Reading First? And again, invoke the science again. When you read in our reading system, which is an alphabetic system, you have to attend to 5 things. We don't have a choice on this. Okay, it's not like we can negotiate it, right? One, you have to listen to sounds. It's called the phonological system. You get a signal that comes in, you grab those sounds, and then you have to take the sounds and map it to the print. That's the alphabetic piece. You have to be fluent at it. That's a fluency piece. You have to understand what you're reading. That's comprehension. And then you have to understand the words. That's vocabulary. We have 5 pieces that we have to put in place. And to do this, you need good programs. Teachers can't do this on their own, make it up as they go along. They have to adopt commercial programs, put it in place, or models that have really tested out all these different pieces. How you thread this in the classroom and at the school level is so critical. You can't just stitch it together any old way you please. So it becomes an enormous effort to scale up and to keep this consistent because kids will... It'll exact the cost on our kids is what we're seeing. So with respect to Oregon Reading First, then, if you look at the bottom slide on page 5, there are different pieces to it. The Oregon Reading First districts and schools. Oregon Reading First funds districts and then districts work with schools in terms of this effort. The Oregon Reading First Center, which is at the University of Oregon. We have regional coordinators that go into the field and work with teachers, coaches, in classrooms, in buildings, and principals. We have a reading leadership team at the state level, and then the Oregon Department of Education. I'm going to quickly fast forward in the next two pages. The top slide on page 6, just, and I may need to apologize this because it looks so basic. We're trying to address three questions. What are our goals? Reading, believe it or not, is so complicated. There's so many pieces. You could, if you focus on everything, with kids who are struggling, you're going to lose it. I mean, it's going to be hard to manage everything. So what we want to do is focus on a few things. Those five things I talked about, the sounds, the alphabet, etc. So what are our goals? How do we do that? How are we doing when we focus on those things? And what are the things we need to get there? So we talk about this in the context of teachers, classrooms, grade level teams, coaches that are experts in the knowledge they bring about reading and how to teach it, principal leadership at the school building level, district leadership in terms of superintendent support, board support, and then at the state level. And that's what you see in the bottom slide. And then on the next slides, pages 7 and 8, is just what looks like kind of an academic model. How do we build this? And you would think that we would have this in place, and we do, but we have it in place, but we can always get better in how we put it in place. And that's just working with the schools, working with the district level, working with coaches to make sure that we're attending to each of those questions. And if we answer a question, what's our data source? How do we decide that? If we decide that a child is not on level, not making benchmark, what data do we use? How are those data decided? How are they collected? So it's really attending to the details. And then the next three slides on pages 7 and 8 really just capture for you, more as background information, what the elements are of the Reading First program. And same with slide number 9. So I'm going to stop there and kind of fast forward and allow my colleague, Scott Baker, to talk about some of the data, because to me the data tell us about how we're doing. So I'm going to call your attention to page number 11 and invite my colleague, Dr. Scott Baker, to talk about the data if that's acceptable to you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm still Scott Baker. Still. So the bottom slide on page 11, so what are the data telling us? We do a lot of data collection in Reading First. Throughout K-3, we collect data on primarily on how well kids are doing, and we collect data at least 3 times per year on every child, in the fall, in the winter, and in the spring. And then for kids who are struggling, and we have very precise definitions for who those kids are, we collect data even more frequently, sometimes as frequently as once every 2 weeks, with the progress monitoring measures, or the DIBELS measures that were talked about earlier. And since they only take a minute to administer, you can actually do a lot of data collection in an efficient amount of time. It's not a burden on schools to collect this information on all of their children, and so the schools are actually the folks who do the data collection. They collect their own data, and in Reading First, we work with them to analyze it and to use the data to make decisions about kids. So they use the data that they're collecting to see how well kids are progressing, to form instructional groups, to identify what target areas of instruction should be hit heavily, and so that, at the school level, then the information is very useful in terms of ongoing instructional planning. We can actually.
May I ask a question? I know we're trying to rush through
this.
Thank you. I'm a little unclear. The Oregon Department of Education is sponsoring this program. Is that correct? But University of Oregon, I'm having a hard time connecting these. And on page 11, one of the slides that you missed, you mentioned has the second bullet, has purchased and is implementing research-based intervention programs and has purchased and implementing, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm a little bit unclear. Is this not offered to all schools? It's offered only to certain schools, and do these schools pay for these programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, the Reading First is a national initiative, so the Oregon Department of Education applied for and received these grant funds. There's two components of the grant funds. One, and that's what we're talking about now, they need to be used for specific schools, and the criteria is very clear. It has to be performance and poverty. And so there's a pool of schools that are eligible, districts and schools that are eligible and invited to apply. So we have 35 Reading First schools now, and we will have in Oregon, and we'll bring another cohort on soon. We have also contracted to provide professional development, because this is very intense in terms of the professional development that the teachers need, the administrators need, the district needs. We've contracted with the University of Oregon to provide the professional development. The schools receive funding, and they purchase their programs through their grant funds. They use their grant funds to purchase programs that have met a certain criteria in terms of being scientifically based and following the requirements of Reading First.
So, you have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they're given the funds, these grant funds, to purchase this program from U of O. Is that, am I understanding? No.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, no, the grant funds are used to purchase commercial programs, Houghton Mifflin, Scotts Forsman, Harcourt Brace, or some of them. There's a list of nine that have gone through very rigorous evaluation that the Department of Education, along with the University of Oregon or the Reading First Center, has done this. It's called a consumer's guide. We evaluate the programs, and then they can select. They take a look at their data at their school. They take a look at where they are, and then purchase a program using their grant funds from these independent vendors. So we don't purchase. The only thing that we provide them, and the University of Oregon, the Reading First Center, would be the professional development and ongoing technical assistance. But the programs are purchased from outside vendors that have to have met the very rigorous criteria.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, that looks like it stimulated another question, if we might.
Mr. Dorney, when you talked about evaluation and the list being seven or eight different types of material, I heard ODE and the university mentioned in that evaluation process. Is there a place in there for practicing educators, too, to be in on that evaluation?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, absolutely. In fact, the committee was made up of practicing educators, district school level folks. It was the Department of Education and the University of Oregon that coordinated the efforts. But it was a very it was representative of school district. In fact, quite a few teachers were made up that review committee of the curriculum materials.
Follow up, please. When you say quite a few teachers, and I don't want to hold it, and I know it is a public, but what percentage of the evaluators were practicing classroom teachers? 90, 60, 32?
Madam Chairman, Representative Dahlem, I would guess about 70%, but I have to go back. I can check that very easily. We have a list. We can just do a head count.
Yeah. Thank you.
And very quickly, is not the University of Oregon one of few reading regional centers in the country that does this preparation or vetting of the various curricula out there? Am I not correct?
Madam Chair, absolutely. In fact, quite a few other states are using for their Reading First schools. They just refer to it as the Oregon list, and that's a list of our vendors that have been approved, and so the other states will have their Reading First schools select materials from the list that we have developed, because it was such a rigorous and comprehensive review of materials.
Thank you. I mention that because I think it's something we should be very proud of, and I think a lot of us are unaware of that particular distinction.
Thank you,
Representative Robles.
And just this is another clarifying question, I think, for some of the other people. Also, like DIBELS, which is a trained assessment process that you train the regular teacher in the classroom to be able to assess the student so they know where they're at. Part of the assessments that you teaching you do is to assess, is to teach teachers how to assess their kids' progress as part of this whole process. So whether it's any one of these programs, based in that is some of the training you provide is to allow the individual teacher in the classroom working with that child the skills to assess that student's progress.
Madam Chair, Representative Roveland, we expect in Reading First School, and this is something we also want to provide outreach to, you know, K-3 schools throughout the state. We expect screening assessments, monitoring, which would be the kind of the dipstick, the DIBELS, some diagnostics. So if students aren't doing well, what do we do? And then obviously the outcome, which is SAT-10 at K-1 and 2, and then the Oregon State Assessment at 3. And there's professional development in how to do those.
Thank you. And we're at our 17-minute mark.
Maybe I'll just cut right to the chase on just some big ideas for the evaluation. After one year of Reading First, we've had 1 year of implementation, and there are many stories we could tell about how kids are doing, and we've got a lot of schools that we could talk about, but if we could just focus for a second on two big ideas. At the bottom of page 12, that first slide, you see a series of bars and grades at the bottom. And the bars, as you can see, are all fairly close to the 100% mark. These are children who come to school in the fall on track. These are kids who we would predict are going to be successful readers. The message here is that across all of the grades, when kids come to school ready to read or already reading in first, second, or third grade, they are relatively easy. It's relatively easy to keep those kids on track. We lose a few kids, but for the most part, it's pretty close to 100%. And those are on not only on the progress monitoring DIBELS measures, but also on comprehensive measures of reading. So it's also on a nationally normed, standardized reading comprehension measure. Okay. If you turn the page and look at yes.
Uh-huh. One clarifying thing on that chart.
Yes.
If you look at K-1 and 2, those are all SAT-10, which is the nationally certified test. 3 is the Oregon State assessment, which is different from those. So, I mean, I think it's important to understand for people here sitting here that there are two tests here, and the third grade test is different from the previous two.
Madam Chair, Representative Roveland, yes, thank you very much. The standardized comprehensive assessment for third grade is the Oregon State assessment. And the reason that you see the bar there that's slightly lower than the others is that we've used the highest standard, the cutoff score of 215. So those are actually children who are exceeding the benchmark. Now, we could have included the cutoff of 201, which is where kids need to be in Oregon in third grade in order to be considered above the basic level, and if we had done that, we would have been at 98%. So there are kids who are on track, and if they're on track in the fall, in the spring, when we assess them, 98% of the children would have scored above the 201 mark, and that percentage that you see in the bar, about 65 or 70%, would have scored at the exceeding benchmark range. Then my last point is if you can just turn the page to page 13, the top figure. What you see here is a very different group of children coming into school. Now, these are children who are, we call them at risk. They're at the highest level of risk in the fall when they start school, whether they're in kindergarten, first, second, or third grade. The highest level of risk. And Reading First, in many ways, is really designed to make sure we identify who these children are and provide them with the kind of instruction they need so that they also can meet the benchmarks that other children meet. What this picture is telling us, if you just look at it very quickly, is that the children in kindergarten who come at risk are more likely to meet the benchmark in kindergarten than other children. So these are all children who met the benchmarks in the spring. They came in at fall at risk, and you can see that the bars are higher for the kindergarten group, meaning more of our kindergarten kids met the benchmark at the end of kindergarten, even though they were at the highest level of risk coming in the fall than the other grades. If you contrast kindergarten with third grade, you can see that those very small bars in third grade, those are children who met the benchmark, but it's a very small percentage because they came in the fall at risk for reading problems. So kindergarten is so far kindergarten is a good area for us to focus on. The last idea is we follow those children now in kindergarten who received Reading First. They will receive Reading First in first grade, in second grade, and in third grade. And then our expectation and prediction for those children is that they will be needing the high stakes outcomes by the end of third grade, given 4 years of Reading First.
One other question. Of the group that met in K, is there any statistical data on how any of those were in Head Start or other programs prior to coming into kindergarten?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, we don't have any Head Start data that I'm aware of. We could probably get it, but it did bring to mind one interesting point about the English language learners. If we were to divide these groups up into English language learners and native English speakers, what we would see is that we're able to get roughly the same percentages of children to the benchmark who begin at risk, at the highest level of risk, for English language learners and native English speakers. I didn't say that very well, but I think you get the point, that we can show that for English language learners at risk, the same percentage of children are meeting the benchmarks as native English speakers. Now, the issue for English language learners is you have many more who are at risk than native English speakers in the beginning. So if we just looked at how many made the benchmark at the end of the year, you'd see a higher percentage of English language learners having difficulty. But if you look at how much progress is made, we have roughly the same percentages for both groups of children.
Madam Chair, Representative Rowland, I think that would be a very important piece of data to collect to see, you know, kind of the educational background that they had when they come to us. That and also the half-day kindergarten and full-day kindergarten are data points that we want to start collecting and do some analysis of that. Yes, and now we'd like to invite Patty, the principal at Aloha Park in Beaverton School District, to come and talk about Reading First at the school level.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patty Book, and I'm principal at Aloha Park Elementary School in Beaverton. I'm really honored to be here to speak with you about what we've been doing at Aloha Park at the building level with regards to Reading First. I'd like to take the opportunity to say a huge thank you to the Oregon Department of Education and the University of Oregon for their amazing partnership. And it is only when I went to a national conference in July with the National Reading First that I realized the impact that Oregon is having all over the country. And it is amazing. The assessment is being used by many states, if not all. Our reputation for crisp, clear, criteria-driven evaluation of programs, commercial programs, is being utilized all over the country. And we are really being watched, and it's an honor to be a part of that. I hope you received a one-page handout that kind of just summarizes some of what I want to tell you about Aloha Park. We're a school of 750 students with high poverty and a large population of English language learners. In addition, one of our major challenges is that we have a 40% in-out rate. That's a little different than mobility. What that means that during the year, out of every 100 students, 40 of those children either come or go, and sometimes two times throughout the year. It's a challenge and one that we're really working with. We're proud of the progress we've made. I think that we're probably one of the schools that has really focused our attention on what we need to do in terms of looking at the research that has been provided to us by the University of Oregon and Oregon Department of Ed with regard to scientifically based instruction, assessment, ongoing monitoring, and clear instructional focus. And I think the results of our assessment, as I put little graphs there for you to see, but if you just look really quickly, you can see that our kindergarten and our first at the beginning and the ending of the year have really, you can see huge improvements in our students, particularly at the first grade level, with over 90% of our students at benchmark or above by the end of the year, with more than a little more than 20% starting there at the beginning of the year. That's an amazing achievement for our first grade. But equally, I think, impressive for my staff is the work that we did with the Oregon State Assessment in just 1 year, and I just put 2 years down, but we were kind of flatlined at about 62% for about 3 or 4 years. Last year, a little over 80% of our third graders met or exceeded benchmarks, and our English language learners were on par. In fact, I just want to share with you that we beat our district English language learner mean. 75% of our students, English language learners, met or exceeded the benchmark, and our district level was 65%. And we're one of the schools, we would say, on the other side with the most percentage of students who speak another language. In our school, I think if you'd come and visit, what you'd see is a very clear focus about reading instruction being our rock. We talk about it as our rock. It's the most important thing, so we put it in the jar first, and we make sure that there's nothing that interrupts that time. So 90% or 90 minutes of instruction every single day, and K through 5, because while we use our reading first funds to support kindergarten through third grade, we've used our Title I funds to support our fourth and fifth grade, and currently sixth grade. This is our first year of having a sixth grade class. So what we've done is we've decided we're going to be reading first K through 6, even though our funding source for our reading first funds are K through 3. We're going to support that with our Title I money, and it really has paid off. So 90 minutes of instruction uninterrupted, that means not a phone call, not a call from the office, not a recess, not anything. 90 minutes continual direct instruction, 30 minutes of which is large group, and 60 minutes is small group. In addition, our students who are at some risk get an additional 30 minutes of reading instruction a day. And our students who are at an intensive level or are severely at risk get an additional 30 minutes on top of that. So if you look at the way the day is spread out, you can see that we've really, you know, kind of zeroed in on reading as being our major goal. We assess three times a year. You've heard pretty much about that. And progress monitor our students who are at risk every 2 to 3 weeks. And our teachers do that assessment, so they have a firsthand knowledge of what is going on. One of the major things that really happened in our school is that this has always been a building, a staff that has done a great job of collaborating. What has happened to us as a Reading First school is that collaboration has taken on a different form. It is intense. We look at specific students. We look at specific data. And we work toward what strategies and best practices do we need to help that student to reach the next level so that that student can be successful. Our reading coach has been a real instructional leader and my partner in, I believe, in this effort. And it has really made a difference to have a coach who can go into the classroom, do demonstration lessons, provide staff development that is on target for what teachers need, help teachers in a stuck with a stuck child to figure out the dilemma of where we need to go and what we need to do and what's the strategy we need to take. She also does implementation checks, fidelity checks. Are we being true to the program? Are we teaching what we said we're going to teach? Are we focusing on what we said we're going to focus on? Is the objective clear, not only to me as an observer, but to the students? Do the students know what they're doing? What's the purpose? What's the goal? And where are they headed? I think another powerful piece for us as a Reading First school has been the impact on our entire building and in all areas of instruction. And I think I want to go back to the Oregon State Assessment. We didn't focus on math. Doesn't mean we didn't teach it. We did. But we didn't focus our efforts on math. But look at our math scores. It's amazing. They came up too. I've had Oregonian call me. What happened? What'd you do in math? It's interesting what happens when your kids can read. They can comprehend. They can understand. They conceptualize. They can do all kinds of things that perhaps they didn't have access to before. A systems approach, I think, is really how I would describe Reading First. And the slide on the packet that you received, number 7, I think is what we've begun to do with other areas of our curriculum. So it's had an impact not only on reading, but how do we use a systems approach in math? How do we use a systems approach in science and inquiry and in social studies and many other things in behavior, management? What do we do that creates an improvement in all areas? So I think that's been our huge piece. We've already talked about the collaboration piece, and the last piece I'd like to add that isn't on this list, and I was thinking of it as I was sitting here listening to the presentation, and that is the impact on our district. 31 elementary schools in Beaverton now have a halftime reading coach because of the success of Aloha Park and Walker Elementary Schools in Beaverton, Oregon. 31 elementary schools are now using Dibbles as an assessment for K-1-2-3 in one of their classrooms this year, and will use it in all of their classrooms, K-1-2-3, throughout the district. That's an amazing sustaining transformation of a district from just two schools that have made some pretty remarkable progress based on the efforts of this grant. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to tell you a little bit about Aloha Park. We invite you to visit anytime you want and see it in action.
Well done.
Yes, thank you very much. You energized us all.
Oh, God.
We're proud you're in place. Is that it?
That's it. Unless you have any questions,
much.
Well, thank you.
Very interesting. We are indeed honored. Representative Roblin.
You brought up the question in your testimony, and I'll give it to Joni. Title I schools. Are all of these schools Title I schools as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, yes, they're Title I schools.
And they're full Title I's, like yours would be a complete Title I school.
School-wide.
Okay. School-wide, so, okay. With supplements. So thank you.
One more question, Joni. We know that these are Title I schools. Is it this program, or is it important that a school have a program for reading improvement?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, could you repeat the question, please?
Is it that in order to show these dramatic results, is it imperative that the school have this program, or that they have a reading program with benchmarks and with a defined approach?
Madam Chair, Representative Dullum, I think what the research says is that it's not as important to have a specific vendor program like Houghton Mifflin or Scott Sporsman, but to have the major components of scientifically based early reading literacy, which is the monitoring, the assessments, the professional development. So those components, teaching to the five big ideas, I think it would be if you want to see those kinds of results, then I think you would need to have those components.
Thank you.
One quick question before we leave this, and perhaps for Dr. Kamei-Inoue. The list of providers of the curriculum, is that something that grows from time to time, or are you in process of evaluating, and how does that occur? I think you indicated there were about nine vendors on the list.
Yes, Madam Chairman, that's a very good question. It does grow. Those programs change. There are different iterations and generations of program, different copyrights. The publishing community is attending very closely to Reading First. This is a national initiative, so publishers understand the marketplace. In order to play in the marketplace, they'll have to design their programs, the architecture of their programs, to be responsive to Reading First. So I think the new generation of programs will be very responsive. But the list will change, and the technical assistance centers, the three technical assistance centers for the United States, will be responsible for reviewing those programs. Yes.
Manager, and in your case with a reading coach, she has at her disposal other resources and other scientifically based programs that may be different than what you have, but for your intense kids may prescribe something different. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, we have a core curriculum that everybody uses, K through 6. And then that's the same program. We happened to choose Houghton Mifflin because it met our needs. And it was the one program that was evaluated last year that really hit all of the five big ideas. It is weak in some areas, and in those areas, that's where we chose our supplemental program so that we can supplement its weaknesses. And then for our intensive kids, what we did was looked at the data and said, which are the programs that would meet and fill in as you look at your systematic instruction, what do you need to fill in for those intensive programs? So the reading coach helps to guide that. In fact, our reading coach was one of the evaluators on many of the supplemental and intervention programs. And we're one of the few schools that have few supplemental programs because we want to do it right. We want to take one thing and do it well before we move on to the next thing. And so we've been very cautious about buying too much because a teacher can't teach so many different curriculums. So we want to make sure that we're doing what's right for our children. So, yes, our reading coach was very involved in that process and in helping our teachers to select the programs.
Madam
One question.
Representative.
Thank you very much. And did I hear correctly you have a 40% non-English speaking student in your school? And I'd like to know the makeup of the 40%. Who are they mostly?
Madam Chair, Representative Lynn, we have 40%. Well, actually, it's I think a little higher than that. 40% are Spanish speakers. We have 55% English language learners. And 15% out of that 55% speak 22 other languages.
All right. Thank you.
So we have students from all over the world.
Madam Chair, I wanted to just clarify in terms of the curriculum review. We have nine core programs. In addition, there are, I believe, about 80 supplemental and intervention programs that have been evaluated and are on an approved list that the schools can select from.
Thank you. One last question. Now, Dr. Burke,
I'm doing a plug for you as well. One of those approved programs has to do with direct instruction that was done at U of O. Isn't that true? That's not the name. But
Madam Chairman, Representative Roblin. Yes, I think there are a couple programs that where the authors were from are at the University of Oregon. Yes.
Wonderful. well, yet another star in your crown. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Dr. Burke from the Oregon Department of Education, and I apologize that we've crept into your allotted time.
Not a problem, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education. We have a lot of information to share with you today, so I'm going to try to do some brief things and then get out of the way. We have some other folks that would like to speak with you within our time frame today. Specifically, we're going to try to do three things, Madam Chair. I'm going to review briefly policy, and my colleague, Brad Victor, is going to talk a little bit about actions that the department is taking. We have two guests, one from the Oregon University System Chancellor Office, Yvette Weber Davis, who will talk about the role of the university community is playing, and colleague Joyce Harris, who heads the Equity Center at the Northwest Regional Education Laboratory, to talk about the work that they are doing in this area, and then Vicki Chamberlain from Teacher Standards and Practices, and Rob Larson from the Oregon Department of Education will talk about licensure and leadership development in this area. So we have three parts. We'll move through it very quickly. In the interest of time, however, let me say right up front, there is a lot of work in our state going on in this area of cultural competency, a lot of very exciting work. It will be impossible, I'm not even going to try, to review all of that work with this committee today. Let me take a minute to direct you to our website and just point out, both for you and for any viewers of this hearing, where they can get a lot of additional information. I mean, specifically, you can look at multicultural curriculum and instructional strategies. There's a lot of information on our website. I am specifically going to refer in the bottom right to school and district leadership, and that will take you to a website called the State Action for Education Leadership Project. You will hear more about that project later today. But as I scroll down, you'll see the Education Achievement Gap, Which Way to a Smarter America. And on this particular part of our website, there are now three new videos that I would direct your attention to. One is a town hall forum that was held at Portland State University. The other is a broadcast of a debate on National Public Radio. Justice Talking is the name of the program, and this is a conversation about school improvement and No Child Left Behind. And then the video that I'm going to show you just a brief part of right now, the work that is happening in Oregon has achieved some national attention, and what this shows you is a little conversation about the work. So I won't play the whole thing. It runs about 20 minutes, but I'll play a little of it to give you a flavor of it. That, of course,
focusing on the development and support of leadership at the school and district level. This work has involved us in identifying and looking at the traits and practices of leaders and how those traits and practices can in turn support increasing student achievement and student success. We've looked at two key areas involving leadership that the state has taken on through the work of our statewide consortium. And one area is the development and support of cultural competence as an avenue for us to address the increasingly diverse student population in the state of Oregon. The second is looking at the relationship between leadership and the improvement of K-12 literacy with an emphasis at the middle and high school levels.
Oregon has made a tremendous stride in the whole area of racism, but then in the area of cultural competency in the schoolroom, it's as if we're just now beginning to hit our stride. Simply put, cultural competency is the ability to work with students who come from cultures other than your own.
The New York Times is very interested in the work that the Wallace Foundation is funding around education leadership and education policy. We've decided to host and help Oregon with this event because Oregon is a state that has taken on the issues of collaboration around cultural competency to a level that we really haven't seen before. We also realize that we're all beholden to help with the next generation. And the students that are currently in school, the teachers that are being trained to teach those students, the parents that are being helped to better interact with the schools, and the schools that are also learning how to better interact with parents, all help build the next generation of citizens for this country. The more engaged citizens are, the more aware they are of their local, national, and global issues, the more engaged and more active they'll be in all aspects of the society.
The Oregon Department of Education has taken some very important steps in helping school leaders, administrators, and teachers become culturally competent. We are doing that through the continuous improvement planning framework that we use for developing comprehensive education, comprehensive school improvement plans for districts and schools in the state. Cultural competence is one of the indicators, one of the quality indicators, one of the components that we look at under the standard of leadership to ensure that administrators and teachers have received this training, are building capacity for cultural competence training in their districts and schools, and becoming more aware of the issues surrounding cultural competence, and they're working with their students in a manner that actually addresses that as well.
It's also important that the system be culturally competent, that our schools be culturally competent, that our districts be culturally competent. And the leadership for making that happen has to come from superintendents, from district-level administration, from principals, and from teachers in the classroom.
Well, the Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory, first of all, is in a very diverse region, and one of the things that we have to respond to is the increasing diversity of students and communities in this region. So we have an equity center, which works with school districts around issues of race, gender, and national origin. And as part of that work, we work with teachers directly to help them to acquire the skills so that they can be more proficient in the classroom with students of different cultural and linguistic backgrounds. I think what Oregon is doing in relationship to the rest of the nation is unique, because I think what we're seeing here is cultural competency being addressed at a number of different levels, at the legislative level, at the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Higher education is involved in this, school districts, and communities. So I think Oregon is way ahead of the curve. And I spent a lot of time in quite a few states outside of this region. And I brag about Oregon because I'm excited to see what we're beginning to do here.
Lewis and Clark College is currently in the throes of revamping its initial and continuing administrative license programs to better prepare administrators to work in communities that serve students of color and wide variety of ethnic and cultural backgrounds. Historically, colleges have been on the tailing end of working with diverse populations. They were content to prepare students in a traditional format. That simply will not work in the future. We have to prepare teachers, we have to prepare counselors, and we have to prepare administrators to work in communities that are much different than the ones they were raised in and worked in the past. I think it's through the extraordinary leadership of individuals on a statewide basis that have challenged the universities and colleges to rethink their curriculum, to rethink expectations, and move from a discussion of diversity into an implementation of cultural competence as a set of skills and attitudes.
Well, school administrators need to be culturally competent because public schools, K-12, is where we see all different cultures, all different kids from all walks of life.
The Wallace Foundation has been heavily involved in supporting public education for well over a decade, and really care deeply about the quality of the classroom experience, the quality of teaching.
but I guess got a little impatient as well with the slow progress and the fact that classroom by classroom wasn't going to do what we needed to do in the kind of time that we needed to do it in. And started to look at what would it take to move from classroom by classroom improvement to school by school, district by district. And the answer was leadership. And we are very thrilled with what Oregon is doing here, because it's really it's can be a leader in the nation. Our initiative is trying to pull out what's happening on state and district level and share that knowledge across the country.
A lot of folks wonder what teacher standards and practices has to do with the cultural competency, and we have everything to do with cultural competency. We set standards for the preparation of teachers and administrators and school counselors and school psychologists. We can use these standards to measure program quality, and we can use these standards to measure teachers' competence through tests and incorporate it into our tests. So I think we are uniquely positioned to change our workforce. I think we're going to have to be courageous about exploring how teachers and administrators work around these issues to help all our children achieve.
The concept of higher education working with K-12 and other partners is essential to any progress that we can make in the state of Oregon regarding cultural competence. Because we train a number of the educators who go into the K-12 school system, it is important for faculty and our administrators in schools and colleges of education to be at the table for these conversations. We are in.
Madam Chair, I will stop there. The take goes on, but again, I hope I've piqued some interest. There's a lot of information on the website, both that video as well as others, where more information can be gathered. So let me briefly talk a little bit about the policy and legislative context here. First of all, what is cultural competence and why is it important? I provided the committee a handout from the state report card. It begins with the top left-hand side, says minority student population increases. And as you notice, one of the reasons that we are concerned about this is the dramatic increase in minority populations, particularly among Hispanic and Latino students in the state. Moving very quickly, you will notice on the page that's marked page 49 that currently, if you look at the bottom chart in the lower right-hand side, 23% of the Oregon student population now comes from various minority and language groups, while only 4.7% of the teaching workforce comes from a minority group. So one major issue in the area of cultural competence is the disparity between the student population and the teaching population, and how do we prepare teachers to teach in a more diverse population. There are three key elements to this that have been addressed at the legislative level. First is creating an environment in which all students and families feel welcomed and respected and valued for who they are in our schools. Second is preparing teachers with effective strategies to work in multicultural classrooms. You heard an excellent presentation about that just prior to our coming up here. And third is the diversification of the workforce itself, recruiting new teachers that reflect different groups. Oregon statutes, beginning back in 1999 with Senate Bill 103, later Senate Bill 555, have addressed several of these areas. I have provided for you a booklet that represents the findings of the first statewide cultural competence summit that was held in May of last year, and I would refer you to the pages beginning on page 67 in the back of that booklet, where you will find copies of the relevant statutes in Oregon law and administrative rule that impact this area. you'll find that the state requires that the Department of Education and the Oregon Department of Higher Education increase its efforts to provide multicultural curriculum, to collaborate to increase minority student access to higher education and to the schools of education, and to collaborate in the recruitment, admission, retention, and graduation of minority teachers, to provide tuition assistance, and to provide mentoring to beginning teachers. So there is a legislative framework here around diversification of our curriculum and our workforce and the preparation of teachers to be successful in a diverse environment. During the 2003 session, the Ways and Means Committee, Education Subcommittee, attached a budget note to the Department of Education's budget. A copy of that budget note is also in your material. And the budget note required that we work in collaboration with teacher standards and practices, the Oregon University System, and other partners to define, first, the proficiencies for teachers and administrators for demonstrating cultural competence, to incorporate training into teacher pre-service programs and other training activities. And the budget note further directed the agency to collaborate with partners on recruiting a more diverse workforce and to review and report back to the legislature on the incentive programs that may be available. We're currently working on that plan for the legislature. So we have been active in a variety of areas. You're going to hear more about that in a moment. I'll just finally refer you in the same booklet to page 3, where as a result of the first Cultural Competence Summit in May, we took major step forwards in clarifying what we mean by cultural competence. And you see the working definition of cultural competence at the top of page 3. Our agency has identified cultural competence as an internal priority. We have established a cultural competency work group within the Department of Education to help clarify our own needs for staff recruitment and diversification of the Department of Education staff, to provide staff training to our own agency, Mr. Victor can talk about that, and to provide interdepartmental collaboration with TSPC, the university community, and others. So I'm now going to ask Mr. Victor to talk a little bit about work that we do internally in the agency around this area, as well as the types of training and other types of services that we provide, and then we'll move forward from there. Brad?
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Brad Victor with the Oregon Department of Education, and I work in the area of health education and American Indian education. Internally, I'll just touch on a few of the trainings that we do to kind of give you the real-life look at what we're doing within the department. In November 03 and in January 05, I facilitated two trainings for ODE staff. These would be these people at the specialist, director, and above level who actually do field work in the field with teachers and administrators on the American Indian Alaska Native Education State Plan. And at these two trainings, I invited in members from Oregon's Native community. The three members who were at both trainings were Ellen Hansen, who is the president of the Oregon Indian Education Association, Brenda Frank, who is the employment and education director for the Klamath Tribe. She's also a member of the Klamath County School Board. Ellen is also the education and employment director for the Coos Lower Umpqua Siuslaw Tribe. And also Jim Thornton, who works with Title VII programs, which are the Indian education programs throughout the state and the schools, and does trainings for them. They talked on areas of about what the Title VII Indian education programs, how they work within the schools, what schools have those. They also talked about the Johnson O'Malley programs, which are federal funds that go directly to the tribes for education with their youth, and also the issue of sovereignty and what that means in dealing with school districts, particularly for our employees when they're dealing with a particular school district that has a strong tribal presence. and also the American Indian Alaska Native State Education Plan, and how that what being implemented into schools can have a definite positive impact on education of Native youth in Oregon. Also, internally, we've had three members of the Oregon Department of Education staff who attended and completed the cultural competency training of trainers, which was last year held at Manuka. And I've also been working with Rob Larson, to bring this training to all department staff. And that is a piece of the cultural competency charter that was completed approximately 6 months ago and is now in process of moving into a work plan. Along with that, I've been working with Mark Hunt, who is our Human Resources Director and Department Administrative Service, in the executive recruitment piece as far as getting the names and information so that within all state agencies, the employment directors for all the 9 federally recognized tribes throughout Oregon can be notified of any openings and active recruitment of individuals from those populations. We also have we call our American Indian Listserv, which reaches approximately 300 individuals within the state of Oregon who are part of the Native education community and either directly or indirectly, and also covers 14 states throughout the United States that we send all Oregon Department of Education job openings out to as far as trying to recruit for a diverse workforce within the agency. Externally, in the health area, which I'm most familiar with, we do approximately 25 trainings per year. These are teacher trainings, and they are in the area of health risk behavior prevention. And these can be in curriculums, or they can just, which are usually 2-day workshops, or they can be in assessment, or they can be in just the workshop format, where they'd be a short 3-hour workshops. All of these trainings have the cultural competency component embedded within them. Our cadre of trainers, which averages anywhere from around 10 to 15. These people are pulled from within the department, but also from out in the education field throughout the state, are trained in cultural competency on how to implement that and how to identify culturally appropriate lessons and culturally appropriate curriculums so that when the teachers look out across that classroom and see a very diverse, they're able to have an impact on all kids within their classrooms. And these are in the areas of, like I say, in health risk behavior prevention, also bullying, harassment, alcohol, tobacco, drugs, and in those types of areas. Also, by the end of the month, February, through very strong partnerships with the government-to-government education cluster, which is made up of representatives from all 9 recognized tribes, we'll be re-releasing the 4th grade curriculum titled Indians in Oregon Today. This has been going through a 1-year review process. And we're this close to putting it back out into the 4th grade classrooms, which will help, of course, add to the cultural understanding of the tribes within Oregon. Also, we've been working with the Council for Humanities on a re-release of the First Oregonians, and this will have sections on all 9 tribes, and then the government-to-government will, our next meeting will be forming a curriculum committee to put together within the next 6 months to a year a curriculum of activities for the students to be able to be used within the classrooms with this First Oregonians. And that, I would say, is about it.
Madam Chair, this is one example. I couldn't bring, obviously, the whole staff. I would love to. Mr. Victor's primary responsibility is in the area of Indian education. As you can see, we're doing a lot. We're doing a lot with other languages as well, particularly Latino students and African-American students. So I wanted to at least give you a taste that this isn't just located in one part of the agency, but is diffused throughout the agency. I'd like now to invite to the podium
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I've sat in many times with the Celilo Parent Advisory Committee. They advise School District 21 and several others on Indian education. If I went and asked them what your agency has done for them, what would they tell me?
The Celilo Parent Committee is not part of the government-to-government education cluster, since they are not a federally recognized tribe. Through Senate Bill 770, which was the formation of the government-to-government relationship between state agencies and the tribes, the only identified partners within that were state agencies and federally recognized tribes. And so, quite honestly, if you were to ask them that, unless they are having some type of communication with, say, Umatilla or Warm Springs, which would be the two tribes in closest proximity, the answer would probably be not much, very honestly.
Do you know, when we look at reaching diversity with those people, they're longest in single inhabitants of any place on earth, and they're not part of this program? If we're going to reach all students, and they do have some serious education problems, mm-hmm. how are you going to propose that we reach those students?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlin, first of all, let's be clear that they do participate. The curriculum materials that Mr. Victor talked about are used in all schools and are available to all children, and so that they would participate. What Mr. Victor is referring to is our work with government to government and the nine confederated tribes, and we are involved in a number of projects to improve education services for Native American youth. To the degree that those services and those programs impact all Native American kids, they would benefit. There are a number of tribes that don't participate. For example, in the Portland metro area, there is a fairly large number of Native American students who do participate in a variety of Indian education programs, but they are not part of the nine confederated tribes of Oregon. They come from other parts of the United States. They aren't in a recognized tribe. They're in a federally identified tribe, but they're not part of the Oregon network of tribes. And that's not part of our agency. That's done at the federal level.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair and Representative Dahlin, if I might just add, too, due to the fact that Hood River School District does have a Title VII program, Indian Education Program, that program more than likely would be serving some of those children from Celilo Falls.
So I think most of them go to the Duper School, I think.
Okay.
Question. Maybe this might be a different tone, but it's a policy question. When any student coming to the school, I understand you are not supposed to ask of their identity, such as the legality of their citizens or not citizens. That's not the issue in the education field.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, that is an excellent question, and so let me clarify. We actually do not ask about whether or not they are citizens. That's a different question, and it's not covered under the Federal Education Records Privacy Act. So we really do not ask, we have no real reason to ask whether or not someone is a citizen of the United States. If they are a resident of Oregon and live in the attendance area, they may register for public education. However, we do ask if a language other than English is spoken in the home. That is called the home language identification form. And every student that registers, particularly if we can, if the secretary or whoever is doing the registration can detect that there might be a second language involved. In the material that I provided you is a chart that indicates what that looks like in Oregon. The home language identification form identifies 138 languages spoken in Oregon schools. The chart that I've provided you only addresses the first 92% of those languages. 72% of the non-English speaking students in the state speak Spanish. That's followed by Russian. And then you can see in the chart the other languages that are formed. So
We do ask if a language is present, because students are entitled to services if a language other than English is provided. But we do not ask about citizenship.
So my comment, Madam Chair, we are just educating anyone coming to our state, as long as they are children, whether it's legal or illegal, or they are visiting for a while, if they come to school, we have to educate them with our own taxpayer expenses.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, that is correct. We educate all children who live in our attendance area, who are of school age, and they are entitled to public education services. Their relationship with other agencies, such as immigration and naturalization, is not part of the education system. That's handled elsewhere. If they are children and they are in need of our services, they receive them.
Okay. One more question, Madam Chair. This is a very important issue. You just talked about it, about that. That's the law, and we have to obey, I guess. And while we are talking about the cultural competency, and do we have any problem on the racial tensions among the minorities? Do you consider any of those things in educating our children?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, absolutely. One of the reasons for doing this is to diffuse any racial tension that may exist, and to build a climate of respect for all cultures and all languages and all races within our schools. It's not only, in my opinion, personally, the right thing to do. I think there is an ethical question here. But it is also the educationally right thing to do. We know that children do not learn as well if they are in climates that are hostile or disrespectful or tense, or don't respect them as individuals. Said in a more positive way, when students are in a climate that does respect their, not only them, but their family, and works to involve families in the life of the school. For example, basic things that you and I would accept as normal represent problems. Let's say that my child is injured at school. It is very disconcerting to a parent to get a phone call from a school about a possible medical emergency, but the person at the other end only speaks English. And as a parent, I'm not able to understand what has happened to my child. Or in the case of special education, whether or not a complex evaluation of the learning abilities of my child has been done, and yet I can't interact with the psychologist who may have done that work. The child might speak English, but how do we incorporate the family into these very important conversations? So when you create climates like that, you have a tendency to diffuse racial tensions and language tensions that occur. I would like to be able to tell you, be my fondest wish, that that had been eliminated in Oregon schools. It has not, and we keep working at that issue to make them as safe and respectful as we can.
Madam Chair, just a small comment. I mean, we are going to be more challenged in the future. When we look at the last 20-some years, Hispanic groups grown more than 600% to 700%. Asian group grown to the 4% total the students. And the funding issue is a great challenge in the future, because I know there are more minorities coming here, legally or illegally. They are coming to our state, and this is a great challenge, the funding of this educating our children in here. So I'm just making my comment.
For the record, so noted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to invite to the podium Yvette Weber-Davis from the Chancellor's Office of the Oregon University System and Joyce Harris from the Equity Center of the Northwest Regional Lab. Unfortunately, Mr. Victor is due in Bend at about 6 o'clock, so he needs to get to that school district. Right.
Well, hello. Thank you very much.
Good Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Joyce Harris. I am the director of the Region 10 Equity Assistance Center that is located at Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory in Portland, Oregon. Just for your information, the program that I direct is one of 10 federally funded equity assistance centers. We're funded by the U.S. Department of Education. And our mission is to assist public school districts to create programs, develop policies, implement practices to ensure that students receive an equitable education. We focus specifically on race, gender, and national origin equity. Historically, the centers were created under Title IV of the Civil Rights Act. We were originally created as desegregation assistance centers to work with school districts around issues of school desegregation. And over the years, our mission has evolved to one where we comprehensively address equity issues. We serve Region 10, which includes Alaska, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Hawaii, Guam, American Samoa, Palau, and Saipan. I just got back from Maui. Doing a 3-day training. Huh?
So you had to
have tough, tough job.
I think we should fine her for that.
Actually, it was very hard because we do a training that very well much fits into this cultural competency piece on sheltered instruction. And it's a 3 or 4 day training, depending on the request of the district. And what we try to do in this training, it's based on a scientifically based research model to work with particularly mainstream teachers who are struggling with the challenge of how to provide an academically engaging educational program for children who do not speak English as a first language. And that's what I bring to this discussion. I work with teachers. I work with the people who we all are depending on to make our schools work for all children. What we frequently hear from teachers is, I don't know what to do. I've got kids from 5 different language groups. I've got kids who speak a little bit of English. I have children who I think they understand what I'm saying. And this is the reality of what is actually happening in our schools. We are demanding and insisting that our teachers provide an equitable education for all children. What we have to do is ensure that they receive, and I'm talking about the teachers, they have to receive what they need in order to be successful. You know, we talk about equity in my center. Equity for us is very simply providing every child with what he or she needs to be successful. I extend that to teachers. How do we provide them with what they need to be successful? I am a teacher. And I'm not going to say a former teacher, because I believe that once you're a teacher till you die. And that's what I see myself as a teacher. And this cultural competency piece, it's very important that we understand the impact that that has on the classroom and what happens in the classroom. When I was doing a training last week, was having a chat with some of the teachers, and one teacher was saying, you know, when I was on the mainland, I had a classroom, and I had some students who were new to the country. They were from Bosnia. And she said, one day the fire alarm went off. And she said, some of these kids crawled up under the desk because they have come from a war-torn area, and a bell like that, symbolic to them of something bad was going to happen. That's just one example of how important it is for our teachers to be culturally competent. If you understand that if you have students who may come from a country where they've experienced war as a way of life, then you need to set aside the time to help those children to understand that, you know, you may hear a bell, an alarm go off, but it doesn't mean that the troops are coming or that the building is going to get bombed. You know, that's part of being culturally competent and aware. We have a population of students that have moved into Oregon. They call them the Somali Bantu. students. And I've talked with teachers who say, you know, these kids, they coming in from an environment, they didn't know what a bathroom was. They're sweet kids, but they didn't know what a bathroom was. And this might seem to be simple, but this is all a part of creating a classroom climate where not only the students who are newcomers, but the students who are there begin to understand their classmates, and teachers understand the students that they teach, so that they can create a learning environment that is productive, that is safe, that is engaging, and that is inclusive. So cultural competency as a concept basically means that you prepare your teachers, your communities, to engage and interact with people from diverse backgrounds in a way that is respectful, that is safe, and that is inclusive. And I think I keep saying the word inclusive because in a classroom that's functioning at optimal levels is one in which everybody is engaged and everybody feels like they want to be engaged. For teachers, it means, and I'm going to say that I'm going to take the liberty of saying I was a good teacher. And I found myself constantly looking for ways to engage my students. You know, every breathing, waking hour, you know, I could be in a supermarket and I might see a cereal box and I'm saying, oops, I can use that to teach my class these consonant blends. So that's what we're trying to reignite in our teachers, this passion for teaching that goes beyond just looking at the traditional student that they've interacted with. What I've given you is a literature review of research on cultural competency. This was developed by one of my colleagues at Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory. We are actually working on putting together a little publication called By Request, and we are actually highlighting some schools in Oregon and in this region to show that teachers who are having success providing education to all children, they do exist. They are using many of these culturally competent teaching practices, and we want to make sure that people know that it's not easy. It will require some work, but the benefits are just amazing. When I walked out to the restroom, I was looking at the bulletin board out there, and there's, you know, the Lewis and Clark thing, the first one, diverse encounters, cultural perspectives, and it made me think of the classroom. The classroom is a place where your teacher, the minute you walk in, you're having diverse encounters. And some of them may be based on the cultural background of your students, may be based on the socioeconomic background. It may be based on how that kid felt when they woke up in the morning. So as teachers, we need to be prepared. We need to prepare ourselves, and our teachers need our support. Our teachers need to have that extra edge. They need to have us saying to them that we know you're good teachers, but we also know that you're facing some challenges with diverse students coming into your classrooms. And one strategy that can help you to be effective is to develop cultural competency. And I think that what we'll see in the long term, we'll begin to see teachers, and I've seen it in the professional development work that I've done. I have come into working with a group, and there may be attitudes, you know, like, why do we have to do this? You know, can't somebody else teach them English? Well, the law says they have to be in your classroom because they're in our schools. And your responsibility is to step back and see how you can use what you already know. And that's the key. Many of our teachers are good teachers. They already know how to be effective. So when we're talking about diverse populations, if we're talking about English language learners, for example, what we say to the teachers is, now what we need you to do is not focus on the fact that this kid can't speak English, but try to use some of these strategies that are research-based in order to help these kids further develop their English language proficiency while they accomplish their academic content goals. And so that's where we're at. With all of our students, with all of our teachers, we're saying we're not going to split hairs here. We're not going to say you teach language over here and you teach academic content. We've got to move them together where you develop the language proficiency while you teach the content. And that applies. And what they find out is that, well, I already know how to do that. Absolutely. You already know how to do that. So we're just going to give you some additional strategies that will help you to do it in a way that will work for these children. And it becomes a win-win for everyone. What I wanted to say, I guess in closing, is that for me, cultural competency is every bit about closing the achievement gap, because it gives us one more tool, one more strategy to use to ensure that as our students move through our systems, that the gap either doesn't get created or as it creates itself, we begin to close it. And cultural competency is one way that we get there. In terms of the research, it's not as voluminous as in other areas, because this is a very new field. You know, we focused on multicultural education as a concept for many years. Now we're looking at cultural competency, and we're looking at ways to identify that when you walk into a classroom. What are the indicators of cultural competency? What are the strategies that have been proven to be effective in a classroom where teachers using culturally competent practices? I mean, this is all pretty new. But what we do have indicates to us that in situations where teachers have used culturally competent practices, there have been gains for students. And I'm going to see if there are any questions and turn it over to my colleague here.
Okay. I am reminded that we have approximately 9 minutes left.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I
would have one question.
Yes.
Good seeing you, sir.
Hi.
Does one particular school jump to mind that you think is doing cultural competency particularly well in Oregon?
Wow, that's a good question. There are classrooms in schools. You know, I would not go out and say, you know, that I could think of a school. I think right now we're at that stage where we have bright spots throughout our schools where you can look and see that there are classrooms where teachers are doing great jobs. Beaverton School District, in my opinion, is doing a very nice job of trying to move their teachers toward cultural competency. I was listening to the principal from Aloha Park, and actually when I leave here, I'm going to call my office and hopefully she's on her way back to Portland and maybe they can catch her, because I think her school might be one that we might want to profile in the publication that we're preparing right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Yvette Weber Davis. I am Director of Diversity Planning and Special Projects with the Oregon University System Chancellor's Office. I am also currently serving as liaison for the system with various education programs. It's an honor to be here this afternoon. For me, this is an interesting intersection of all the things that are part of my professional life. The topic of cultural competency is one that is hugely important at all levels of the educational spectrum. But what I wanted to really focus on, and I'm going to be very brief knowing that your time is short, because I know that we have another segment here. The packet of information that I gave you, I hope you'll have a chance to look through it, actually relays information about our recent higher education efforts in this regard. And this is talking about the training of pre-service educators. So before they're in the classrooms or before they actually are going into field experiences and gaining the knowledge and pedagogical skills to really be effective educators, the types of things that are going on to enhance those experiences. I will just very briefly mention that we gathered at the end of November. The segments that you saw in the video were taped during that day. We had 140 faculty and administrators from colleges and schools of education throughout Oregon. So 18 higher education institutions were represented, as well as four community colleges, to discuss these issues and really dig down into not only looking at what we're doing currently, what might we do to enhance our efforts, and where are we really going in terms of statewide partnerships in this regard. And so the information in your packet speaks to those activities. I will point out at the very end, the ivory sheet is an article from the Oregonian, and I think it is a powerful commentary on what we were trying to achieve that day. It was a piece written by Robert Landauer, who I thought spoke very eloquently to not only what the issues are, the background, but what we are attempting to do to pull together to address the issues better. I will say that our work is not focused on that one day or one effort or existing efforts. We are continuing to move forward. We are continuing to make progress. And the very powerful thing is that even though there are six public institutions in Oregon, OUS, Oregon University System, OUS institutions that have educator preparation programs, there are also 12 private institutions in the state. And so we're working collaboratively because we know that we are very, very involved and aware of what we're doing in the public sector, but also I think the exciting thing is that the private institutions are also a part of this conversation. I will stop and ask if there are specific questions that you'd like me to address.
In talking with the university systems that have teacher education programs, will this program be part of the teacher preparation program? Is that the direction they're traveling in?
Madam Chair, Representative Dallum, actually, I will point you to the packet, pages 3 through 9. There are a number of initiatives. This is the packet, Oregon University System, in which the institutions are currently engaged. This is everything from specific courses to publications and books that are being written by our faculty members to field experiences for the pre-service educators and other types of activities that are comprehensive. And so these initiatives are part of the processes in terms of education programs already. What we're seeking to do is making sure that we're enhancing, drawing upon the other expertise and partnership.
Simple question. Will this be required before a student graduates from our university system?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, I made it more complex than it needed to be. I apologize. What I was trying to convey is that it's not one course. We're trying to infuse opportunities for cultural competence into everything that we're doing in the
And while we are discussing cultural competency, I hope that we can include the values and cultures and languages they are bringing with them when
Absolutely.
They come here.
Absolutely.
And make sure they preserve and learn and continue. Maybe they could be a good ambassador in the future of their country they come from. And one other point I like to bring it up, sometime in the future, minority members all together becomes the majority of the school.
Absolutely.
So when we're talking about their cultural competency, we need to consider the Caucasians become the minority. And so we need to include the whole section, not just small minority groups alone. So I'm just talking about a little ahead in the future.
Madam Chair, can I just add one thing? please. I neglected to say that this particular literature review was requested by Rob Larson of the Oregon Department of Ed. And it's just one way of showing how the State Department of Ed is utilizing resources that are in some cases funded by the federal government to serve our area. But I think it indicates the foresight that Rob had, that the lab could provide this. And then the other comment I wanted to make is the program that I direct, since we are funded by the U.S. Department of Ed, all of our services to public schools is free of charge to them. It's at no cost. So that is another linkage in a way in which we support and have a collaborative relationship with our state, within our state.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I realize that we are out of time, so we will end this here. With us was Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices, directed to Representative Dahlem's most recent question. TSPC at the January 13th meeting approved a new set of administrative licensure standards for the state of Oregon. There are 7 new standards, and each standard has connected to it a standard for cultural competence. That was the first step, Representative Dahlem, to infuse this into the requirements for all Oregon administrators. That work took about 2 years to be done and is now completed. Senate Bill 50 was approved by the Senate Education Committee with a do-pass recommendation to the floor. It will be coming before your committee. Senate Bill 50 authorizes TSPC to establish similar requirements for teacher licensures. So that's the next step, Representative Dahlem. And how does this work get infused into teacher work? And the leadership development work that Mr. Larson was going to talk about will continue. We have a number of conferences coming up. I think we have some handouts for you. We can give you that information via paper. The exciting thing here is the interest that has been generated nationally, both through the New York Times and the Wallace Foundation. And the message that I would like to leave you with is the reason for that interest is the multi-institutional connection that we've tried to develop here. This is not just the Department of Education. It involves the role of the legislature in establishing expectations in this area. It involves the university community, the Department of Education, our community partners, and, of course, local school districts and communities. So it's a pretty broad, far-reaching effort. We appreciate the opportunity, Madam Chair, to share it with your committee today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Burke, and with apologies, we would love to hear from you. Perhaps we can fold it into yet another session. Thank you for your forbearance. It's just all such good information. We just drill down and get carried away. with that, ladies and gentlemen, this committee will stand adjourned. And Representative...